As digital disruption continues to make headway across every part of our day-to-day life, it has become more important than ever to continue to evaluate how and in what ways it's impacting us, both good and bad, and assess what more needs to be done. In payments, the move towards digital options like e-transfer, e-wallets, and digital currencies has made many of these day-to-day interactions faster and more efficient. But many challenges and questions remain. Hi, I'm Justin Farabee, Chief Operating Officer at Payments Canada, and I'll continue to be your guide on the PayPod podcast, a multi-episode series on everything to do with Canada's ambitious payments modernization mission. On the last episode, we discussed modernization within the context of small and medium-sized businesses. Today, we'll look at a new side and focus on how innovation in payments will make a difference for Canadians across generations. Joining me to dive deeper into this is a group of panelists that each bring a unique point of view to payment modernization. We have Shannon Lee Simmons, who is a millennial personal finance expert, author, and financial planner. We have freelance journalist and author Carrie Marsh, and David Krevet, Vice President, Zoomer Live and Zoomer U. Excellent to be with you all on the PayPod.
It's nice to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Looking forward to it.
Okay, let's get into it. As a recent survey commissioned by Payments Canada revealed, while digital options exist, traditional methods of payments like credit cards, debit cards, and cash come out on top. However, more than half of Canadians say they are willing to move to electronic payments on their mobile phones. To all of you, in knowing that many Canadians are open to this change, why do you think people still resort to traditional forms of payment?
I think that we like what we're comfortable with, especially when it comes to money. It's, you know, you grew up using checks or a credit card and that's what you know. So that's what you rely on. And so I think it's just that comfort.
Yeah, this is what I know. And I would also, I'd be interested to know how long it took for people to go from using cash to debit or cash to credit cards when that shift really happened. Was it a slow burn or did it happen overnight? Maybe we're just expecting it to happen so quickly when really people are just slow to take on anything with their money because it's money and you don't want to risk it at all.
I think that's true. And I think that it's compounded by an awareness problem of what the alternatives are. Mm. It's not as if there was one magic day where the alternative was completely figured out and we all had an equal chance to find out about it and some of us haven't found out yet. I think it's emerging. Is it a creature of my bank? I think for most people, what is your bank offering? That's usually your pipeline to changing your behavior. My bank lets me do this online. And they've now got this online and kind of I go with them. But I think that there's a big gap in awareness of what's out there and how to access it and what it means.
And are each of you using these old payment methods primarily?
If by old you mean debit and credit, yes, absolutely.
And cash?
I barely use cash, if I'm honest. I think, finding change for the TTC is hard to do in my house. So I'm definitely a debit kind of gal.
Well, in my case, I pay, I would say, probably 95% of bills through online banking. I use credit cards for physical trips to a store or a restaurant or debit, increasingly a debit card. But it's really a card. I mean, if I'm in the store or in the restaurant, I take out a card. But I pay all my bills online if I can.
I use everything. I use debit, credit, checks, cash. And I think that that's a lot to do with the stage of life that I'm at. I have two young kids, so every week I need to scramble around for Toonies for pizza day. You know, I have a babysitter. I pay her with checks because that's easier for me to track it tax time. Yeah. Yeah. You know, so I do think that there's a certain life stage that demands a certain way of using money. And that's definitely my sort of Gen X life stage is that I need it all right now.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair for baby boomers too. You know, where you have bills with large institutions, be it utilities or department stores or wherever, you could conveniently pay online. You need to write some checks. I probably don't use cash. There might be weeks when I don't use any cash at all.
Yeah. And do you use your mobile phone for your banking? So have you made the switch from online banking to, or branch banking to online banking to mobile banking?
I have my bank's mobile app on my phone, and unless it's the biggest barrier for me to mobile is the screen size and typing stuff in, so it's easier if I can see it, you know, on my laptop. but I'm quite comfortable. I transferred some money this morning on my phone, no problem.
I'm so glad you said that about the screen size, because that's exactly why I don't do mobile. I don't like to do much on my phone other than, you know, listen to podcasts, but I definitely use my desktop computer to do all my banking.
Yeah.
I almost exclusively run my banking through my phone. Yeah. Such a millennial.
Your young, sharp eyes can handle it.
Do you think that, there's this sense of you do your banking, mobile or online, and then you have the things that you pay with. And you may make a deposit with a check with your online, with your mobile, but you actually, all your payment is separate. Do you think it's that it's just not easy enough to come across and use it, or it's effort to make it happen, or it's not, is it risky? Is it kind of like a self-driving car? Even though it works, you still feel really uncomfortable not being there?
I do think that there's a risk element out there, whether that's, you know, fair or not. I think that even though the Facebook debacle is not related to banking at all, I do think that those kinds of incidents in the news make people feel uncomfortable about the security of their data, the security of their money. I do think there's this sense that maybe it's not quite as safe as we all wish it would be.
I think it's really a come back to awareness. I mean, in my own case, and I don't know how typical or untypical I am of my generation, I literally don't know what to do instead of paying my bills online. I'm talking about bills. A restaurant or a store, I take out a piece of plastic.
You got a couple choices.
And, but I literally don't know, because I've got recurring bills set up with vendors, set up, you know, pays that in my bank. It's very easy. I drop down, I click who it is. I set up certain recurring payments, for example, on credit cards. I don't know what to do next. So it's not so much that I've rejected some better alternative. I'm in a state of zero awareness of what that alternative would be. Literally zero.
I think your point is true, very true. Yeah. I would actually just validate both points. Anytime that I've spoken to clients or even my peers, I have, you know, a friend that was working on a mobile e-wallet, and everyone's like, "What is that? What does it do? What's the value prop? Why wouldn't I just use my card?" And so, if I have to take something out of my purse or out of my bag to pay anyways, why isn't it just my card? So I think that there's a lack of understanding of what the value proposition actually is, and why I should bother.
And then it may even be just an incremental improvement. Whether I'm tapping my phone or my card is.
So what's the point?
Yeah, what's the big prize here?
Yeah.
The other thing too, I mean, just from a convenience point of view, and again, this, you may say to me, well, everything you just said you could do with your mobile wallet, but in my experience, so I can go online at my bank and I can see all the payments to that vendor. I can search those payments against my checking account, my savings account. When's the last time I paid them? What did I pay them? I've got all that figured out already. And it's not that hard or inconvenient to go onto my laptop once or twice a week and do that stuff. So I'm not sure why it needs to be mobile, or what the advantage would be. So again, it's an awareness issue.
I think another issue is even just, you know, we were chatting before we got started, and there's not even a consistency in the nomenclature yet. You know, some people refer to the wallet as the place where they put their plane tickets or their concert tickets, you know, and maybe there's some banking information. So I think a lot of people are using this mobile wallet word, and it's like, I don't know that we all understand it in the same way even.
I don't think we do. I understood it as being that that's where I have credit cards instead of physical credit cards.
Yeah, where a cryptocurrency wallet means there's actual currency in it.
I've seen people in a store hold up their phone and instead of taking out a credit card. So I guess if you're saying don't carry around all that plastic, have it all encoded on your phone, hold up a screen. If I may be even wrong, that may not even be what it is. But in terms of paying bills, particularly if it's, you know, if it's Hydro, if it's Enbridge, if it's department stores, I mean, that's not something I need to be mobile for.
Yeah. So that's a good survey of current, that there's multiple. We're in a transition period. There's some new stuff. There's some old stuff. It works for certain things, to pay a babysitter, or there's, and each of us is adapting to reflect our habits, our stage of life. If we started to look forward, and rather than just not carrying a card as being the prize, that we said, well, what could be possible with payments? And we started to look at the idea of programmable money, as in if I am somebody who manages my finances more from a paycheck to paycheck level, I might want to say, don't, rather than have an automatic debit that comes out when I don't know exactly when or the amount I don't know or it's double debited for whatever reason, I'd like to control that. So don't take out my Rogers bill if my balance is below $200. And then Rogers could come to me and I could say, can we debit? And I could say yes or no. And you could start to insert yourself on the payments on your phone, or you could even do programming, if this, then that. If my pay happens on this time, then move my payment to 2 days after my pay. Or you start to say, if I reach a certain limit in dining out, don't let me dine out, or some version of that. But you start to put things in that allow you to gate it so that you don't get an NSF or something like that. Do those kinds of things sound like they might be interesting to you?
Yeah, I think that would be cool. I think it would be great if you could help take advantage of somebody's good intentions with their finances and empower them to make those decisions in the moment when it's actually happening. So a lot of times, you know, someone would leave my office and be like, I'm going to do this. And then that good intention can leave. And so if you've actually brought that home and it's like, this is happening right now, do you want to make a financial decision? It's a reminder of being mindful, like, I'm about to make a financial decision. Maybe I should think about that. So that could be, exactly. So that could be a really, really neat way to engage a consumer to actually use their financial planning on the day-to-day basis, which is actually how all financial planning happens, right? It's in your day-to-day life.
And it's actually the feedback, if there's too much distance between when you get the feedback and when you make it. So right now, my bank statement comes 30 days later. I look at it, it's like, ooh, I shouldn't have done that. I should, could have, should have, would have. And I don't, it's not in. So we could, with the information, also give context to decisions.
Yeah, and help that behavior shift along the way.
But how many people are waiting for a bank statement to come?
Maybe not that many.
The boomer here, where the older, supposed to be the most conservative, and least prone to tech, but that's not true. But I mean, my bank statement for me is 24/7, 365.
It's like online, yeah, right?
Yeah. Where do I sit? What have I got? What do I want to do? Move it around or not?
But as a freelancer, those things would be a huge advantage to me. I don't have a predictable income. It's always changing, you know, and we all know that the gig economy is growing. And so more and more freelancers are going to be out there. I think that those kinds of things would be a huge benefit. One of the hardest things about managing your money as a freelancer is that predictability. You know, it's not like my paycheck drops on the 15th and so I set up all my payments after that. It's always a bit of a surfing game and it creates a lot of anxiety.
We are trying to or move payments toward to be sub-commercial in that you just do your regular life and the payments are happening kind of in the background. Like you said, it's invisible. I want to manage my life and then I want the payments to be executed as per what I'm managing and not be, it shouldn't be a thing to have to pay. Like you see the Amazon store in the US where you just go and you pick something out, you walk out and it pays for you and there's a, big deep breath there. It's, how does that all that work and who's getting access to my account? But do you think that that idea of sub-commercial payments where it just happens in the background for you is interesting? I see you shaking your head. What is the... both of you. Okay.
I agree with the idea that you want some sort of technology to help facilitate your life and it shouldn't be so choppy all the time. You want a smooth transition. But the idea of no checkout purchasing... I mean, I'm on the front lines of financial planning every single day. I'm talking to real people living their life. And I'm telling you right now, that is a recipe for potential disaster because we are human beings who have weak moments. And when you don't have to stop for 1 second and have a check-in or be mindful about what's happening, like what you're doing, that leaves the door wide open for completely overspending. If this was all hooked up to debit, that's one thing. But then if you've spent all your money and rent is due the next day, what do you do at that point? And if it's hooked up to credit cards, well, that's even there's potentially no real ceiling on that. And so we, as human beings, we have a capacity to ignore the information that's helpful. So even if you had an alert that was like, you shouldn't walk out of that store right now, screw it.
You can't afford it.
I can walk out of here and do as I please. And I don't even need to have that fear of having an NSF on my debit card. Like, that's a thing, right? And so I believe from a personal finance point of view, strictly, that a sober second thought or a moment of inconvenience can save people a lot of money and a lot of potential trouble down the road.
So it's a management tool. The friction of payments is a management tool of your finances.
From a personal finance point of view, absolutely.
And no surprise that big companies, big retailers mm-hmm. are pushing for this.
Right.
Oh, I detect a bit of suspicion there.
Well, of course, if I'm Amazon or Whole Foods or you know, whoever, I want you to be able to spend as easily and with as little resistance as possible.
Yeah.
That's of
but are there
course
not
my
times,
goal.
Is there not times when that's helpful? So the payment facility at Uber made it really easy. So it's that actually is part of what makes that work is Airbnb fixing the check changing and all that kind of stuff. Isn't there times when making it easier works?
Well, Airbnb, you know in advance what you're spending. So yes, if that's easy, great. You've already decided in advance, I'm going to stay at this place. It's going to cost me $140 a night or what have you. You know. I don't think that's the same as being in a store and loading up your cart.
And not knowing how much you're buying.
Well, or maybe not really just, you know, as Shannon said, just taking that second to say, is this really the right choice to buy this?
Can I afford it?
Can I afford it?
Here I think there is a generational difference because I think that the long-term effect will be much more favorable with the older generations for what you're talking about. They are conservative savers. They're watching the money more carefully. And I think you have to make a distinction for the purpose of this conversation between what is desirable, because I agree with you as a financial planner, don't just go into the store and check it without knowing, but what's desirable and what the market wants may not always be the same thing. There's going to be an insatiable demand as far as the eye can see from older consumers for more convenience. And so the need to just, it happens, it's paid for, I've got it covered, I built it into my planning tool. If you think you're going to be going into Amazon and checking out without checking out, that's just now. 10 years from now, I mean, they're working on the Amazon, the Walmart, even more than Amazon, truck will drive up to your home with all the stuff that you've ordered and just deliver it. You won't even be in the store. The store will come to you. The convenience store industry now is hearing speakers at their conferences that 15 years from now, all the drones won't be owned by Amazon. They'll be owned by you. You'll be sending your own drone to the store to get the stuff and bring it back, all paid for before it even happens. And in a society where people are living longer, the fastest growing age group are centenarians. Mobility is an issue. Getting out is an issue. The inconvenience of shopping is an issue. Multiplied by winter is an issue. The more it can come to me that's seamless and frictionless, bring it on. That's going to be your biggest market, I predict. And I know it's counterintuitive to say
it's
that's going to be your biggest market. I'm sitting at home. I want it all to come to me. And don't you worry. I know where the money is. And all my planning tool
that's
will
the
take
key.
Care of all
you
that.
Got the money. Good. The boomers. I got it.
But the planning tool. No, but I want the planning tool to do it for me. The planning tool will figure it all out. I can sit there. All the stuff's going to come to me. Because I don't want to get in a car.
And you want the planning tool to also manage the drones.
And drive through the snow. And who might?
Now going further out, what about cryptocurrency? Bitcoins, other things, would you trust those as a payment method?
Do you mean the technology or do you mean the idea of a cryptocurrency being a store of value that I can buy, I can actually buy?
The latter. So you have a bank account, would you also have a crypto account? And if it was easy and convenient, would you see any difference between that currency, this currency?
No. I mean, I can't pretend to really understand it or to have spent a lot of time looking into it, but I feel like money is a conceit and cryptocurrencies are a conceit. And if that's the going currency, then that's fine. I'm not, I don't know if you remember this book from the 60s, The Zen of Motorcycle Maintenance. I am not that person. It's like, I don't need to know how the microwave works to use the microwave. If people are using cryptocurrency, I'll use it. I don't need to like dig into the granular understanding of it.
Yeah, I agree. It's like seeing a Visa or MasterCard logo in a store window. We accept Visa. If we accept a cryptocurrency, if it becomes a unit of exchange, remember, we're talking about using it to pay for, not speculating in it.
Right, it's not an investment.
Quote, another issue. But if somebody accepts it, then they accept it. If I can go walk in and pay for something with cryptocurrency, sure.
I agree. If it's a unit of value, like a stored value that everybody agrees with, and you can pay with it and actually use it as an exchange of value, then it would be something. I think the only thing that would scare me would be the volatility of it. And how do you know what people, that we accept this today, maybe not tomorrow, and maybe it's worth 10 more, like 10 times what it is today, tomorrow, and maybe it's worth less. I think that would be the only thing that would stop me from using an actual cryptocurrency as a currency, not as an investment, would be the volatility of it and not really knowing what that stored value is tomorrow.
Great.
The most conservative is the millennial.
Yeah, curiously enough.
No, I think that would apply everywhere. It's too soon. I mean, maybe 20 years from now it'll become.
And I guess the question is the context for what, how much?
For what? And then how easy is it to switch? So if it becomes...
Right. Is it interchangeable?
You know, I could pay for something in U.S. dollars. I could have a U.S. dollar account as a consumer now, not as a speculator. And even if it goes up or down a few cents a year, the Canadian dollar in relation, I'm not speculating in it. I'm just, so I have a couple thousand bucks of U.S. dollars and I, for whatever, I'm going to, you know, Buffalo every so often, and I'm not going to get hurt on the exchange. If cryptocurrency became that interchangeable, and I said, okay, have some thousands of dollars worth of crypto in your
as a hedge,
bag of tricks, then fine. But I don't think people, the moment you got to buy a bunch of it and invest in it, then it's...
And it's volatile, then it's a different
volatile,
question.
Then you won't do it any more than you'd buy U.S. dollars there. You might keep a few thousand U.S. dollars if you're going there often, but if you're going to buy, going to a bank and lay down 100 grand worth of greenbacks, you better be sure it's not going to be worth a lot less. You can get really hurt.
Do any of you have a stash of cash? We're not going to chase you down, but I wonder if you ever worry that maybe, you know,
bring a wire?
If there's like all this dependency on this electronic infrastructure, that something were to happen for a period of time, what do you do? Do you have cash, or do you think actually somebody will solve that problem?
Like actually under the mattress?
Oh, it could be in your freezer too. I mean, I don't have a bias to where you keep it.
But. I do not, but my husband does, and I know where it is because he's a bit... paranoid. So yes, he's the person who's thought of that scenario. I would just be like, it's fine, you don't ever need that. But there's like
you
a little
never know.
There's a little metal box in our house. So come over if it happens. You know, we're the ones who are going to help you out.
I have $500 cash in my house at any given time for mad money. And so my mom always called it mad money, and it was ingrained in my brain. And so that's there. It's not enough to do any real damage with it. But it's there just in case you need $500 of mad money for whatever reason. Get out of Dodge when the zombie apocalypse happens.
Just enough to get far enough out.
Yeah.
But don't forget, this is interesting though, because we talked earlier about the invisibility. So the institutions that we rely on, i.e. the Bank of Canada, the banks, the ministers of finance, have created the impression, and it may be completely accurate, I'm not making this as an accusation, that nothing can go wrong. And that impression started back in my great grandparents. That when the daily exchanges were by paper, I presume the banks cleared their checks manually in some room at the end of the day. For all I know, so the system was supposed to be that nothing can take down the system, and we all rely on that. So if that's not true, then I would suggest we've got bigger problems than can be solved by a stash of cash.
Yeah, and I want to reassure you, the system's safe.
Yeah.
It's not The Handmaid's Tale?
I assume so.
Yeah, your debit card doesn't work.
Because I think there's redundancies and stuff built.
Yeah, it's all planned for, and there's a lot of business continuity planning, and it was just one of those questions about suspicion or, you know, just your own risk tolerance and what you do and that kind of stuff. That was So let's move internationally now. Let's see what's going out in the rest of the world and see if it were to come here, how would you feel about it? So we'll travel east first. If we look at China with WeChat and Alipay, where these platforms are taking over the payment system with a penetration in the upwards of the 70-80%, where you are paid into your WeChat and you use your WeChat to pay your tax, or you put wherever you're going, that it is ubiquitous, it is accessible, it is fluid, it is friction-free, and you can move through anywhere, and it all goes into the same place and comes out of it kind of like a Facebook only for payments and other things. What do you think if that were to come here?
Well, I do think, as someone who works, I'm a freelance writer. I have clients in the States, in Europe. I travel quite a bit in Europe. I think I would really welcome a platform that made payment and receiving money more more easy. You know, often when you're paying for things in Europe, they want to use a wire transfer, which is, it's very easy in Europe. It's very expensive in Canada. Often when I'm getting paid by an American client, there's all sorts of paperwork involved. I would really welcome something that made those international transactions more painless, right?
I think for an international purpose, if I was in your situation, it would be. But otherwise, it's just, it sounds like just a replacement of everything I get from the bank now.
Yeah, not a big change.
So it pays my income, goes into my bank account automatically. My bank account disperses funds everywhere, including the U.S. I would say 85% of our household shopping is online, including increasingly food. It's all settled through the bank, whether credit card, debit card, e-payment. So I don't know what Alipay would do that I'm not already getting. That's my dilemma. Now, if I was having to make payments overseas, maybe, but I think that's a small percentage of of the market. So I'm not sure what other functionality they offer that I'm not already seeing, because I'm getting that one stop inbound, outbound
through your bank, which
through
you
my
trust.
Bank now.
Yeah.
So
great. Okay, let's look west. So open banking is in Europe, and there's a version of that that applies just for payments, so payments data. And as we are discovering, payments data is helpful data if you want to learn things. So the applications, you know, the hackathons where people come up with all these great ideas, have come up with a lot of ideas on what you could do with payments data. And there are some very serious things, like if you have a mental illness or some other medical condition, your payments could have a pattern, and when you deviate from that pattern, it could alert a caregiver who could help out. So it would be a very good way of understanding behaviors in support of keeping you on a track that you wanted to be on. So it's a very helpful view, and there's many versions like that. And then we have that are more novelty but are telling, and that is your payments data says a lot about you, that there are now are in progress or suggested that we could have a dating app which is based on your payments data, that you're more accurate to describe who you are based on what you spend your money on than on any profile you complete or any values thing or any kind of other mechanism that you use to describe yourself. What do you think about that?
That makes me want to cry. So absolutely, your payments data says absolutely everything real about good, bad, and ugly about who you are. You give nobody a shot. Everyone will be single forever. Or will match. Or what I could see happening would be, this person has a terrible credit rating. So does this person has a terrible credit rating. And let's match them together because they clearly like blowing money on the same things, right? And so you have these financially terrible couples and then these financially wonderful couples. And what would that do for natural selection? I don't know. I feel like that data, I mean, I'm being facetious, but the amount of data that you could get from what people pay for, even if there is good, I worry about what it could do. It's so much personal information. And I would argue maybe the most personal information that you could possibly get from somebody, who you are when no one's watching. And so I feel afraid for that type of information of a person to be in somebody else's hands.
But I can also see it being terrifically popular. I agree with everything you've said.
The underlying assumption is it's opt-in, obviously. I mean, they can't do it without your consent.
Correct. Correct.
So to me, it's a non-issue. It's just another piece of information about yourself that you choose to reveal or not, depending on who you're revealing it to and what you think they're going to do with it. If you indicate your sports preferences and your sexual proclivities, why not your payment?
Well, but I
tendencies think, if you want to do it and it's transparent.
I think it's a little bit more explosive just because I think it makes clear how many people feel about class, which is that they want to stay in the class that they feel comfortable with.
Yes.
And so this is a way of talking about class, you know, that doesn't get right to the point.
Right.
And which is why I think a lot of people would be drawn to it, that they want to stay where they're comfortable.
It's also interesting you have a reaction at first, which is that's so personal.
It's very personal. Like
your finances is a way of describing you, and it's very personal. It's interesting how that...
Not even so much what you make, but how you spend. Mm-hmm. The most personal.
The choices, because it reflects your choices.
Your behavior, right? Yeah.
Can I let me throw two curves at this if we're predicting what'll happen? So already it's been estimated that a quarter to a third of the profiles on LinkedIn are fake. 25% of the profiles on Facebook are fake. People are going to create fake spending profiles, fake identities. They're going to create virtual personas. We're already in a world of avatars, of virtual websites, of people that are spending more time online, particularly people that are socially challenged with, you know, fake identities. So I think there's going to be a lot of risk for the payment at the other end. You're assuming everybody's got this totally legit data that we're hoarding. What happens if we decide to game the system? Second thing I think that's coming, I know I'm way out on a limb here, but it's been discussed, is affinity groups that can be organized on the consumer side. So what happens if 1 million high net worth people find each other and say, we're going to charge for our data. We're not going to give you our data for free. Facebook. You can't drop a cookie. You want to drop a cookie on my computer? $5. That's coming. People are going to realize, because as the CEO of Apple said about Facebook, he says, at Apple, our product is phones. At Facebook, their product is their consumers. So why should I supply them with product gratis? So the day is coming when the consumers will figure out how to aggregate themselves and charge the institutions for the privilege. And when that happens, look out, because then the possibilities to organize affinity groups, buying groups, consumer groups, and say, you can't have my data at all unless you pay for it. And then you're going to see the cost of market research multiply by orders of magnitude, because we're suckers now. We're just giving up this stuff gratis and letting the companies resell it for money. Why should we?
Great point. Thank you all for your sound advice and comments and for offering a closer look into how each generation is being impacted by the payments evolution in Canada. That's all the time we have for this episode, but join us next time on The PayPod when we delve into the world of payments. The show is available at payments.ca, and join the conversation online using hashtag modernpayments.